The next case on our oral argument calendar is also by ITV, and I believe the same locations are involved. The case is, I'm going to try to pronounce this right, is it Sakala, I believe, versus Commissioner of Public Safety? And counsel, if you could just say a few words so that we know that you are present in the courtroom and at the camera. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Please come, Your Honor. Thank you, Your Honors. I'm here from the Attorney General's office. I don't know if you can hear me or see me, but...
Both. We can hear you and see you, and if we find out, and if we, once we find out your opponent is ready, we'll call the case and get you rolling. Okay, say a few more words so that the camera switches over, then we'll know you're there.
Rich Gambling, here for the appellant, Your Honors. Am I coming through?
Okay, now you're present. Excellent. So, is it Sakala? Is that the correct pronunciation? All right, so the next matter on our calendar is Sakala versus Commissioner of Public Safety. 15 minutes to each side to present your arguments, with an additional 5 minutes to appellant counsel to use for rebuttal if you'd like to use that time. The timing restriction should be indicated on the screen, and we just ask that you stop when the time comes for your argument to be concluded. Please state your name as you commence each leg of your argument so we can keep track of it in the audio recording. All right, you may proceed.
What we have here is a case where the appellant was walking on the street, the officer came up and immediately seized him. The district court stated in its order that there was a brief time, however brief it was, where the appellant was free to terminate the encounter. I believe, as does the appellant, that is incorrect. The officer stated that as soon as he walked up, and it's in his testimony, that he was interrogating the appellant, and the appellant was not free to leave.
When you say, are you making a distinction between seized and detained when you use the word seized?
Well, he wasn't free to go and was being interrogated. I would say the seizures, you're not free to leave, but I think there's a blurry space between being arrested, where you have a Miranda right, when you're in a formal custodial interrogation, and when you're just happening, the other extreme would be when an officer just walks up and talks to you, which is what the Attorney General argues in their brief, that you don't have any protections. I would state what we have here is a situation less like an officer walking over and talking to me and just determining that I'm drunk or have alcohol on my breath, and more like the situation in Farah, which I cite in my brief. It's an unpublished opinion, Your Honor, where an officer walks up and talks to an individual, and that becomes a custodial interrogation by the nature of the encounter. I list all the factors that I believe make this case much like the Farah matter.
What about a traffic stop? A traffic stop, the driver's not free to leave. Are you saying that's a custodial interrogation circumstance?
I would say that it can become one under those same factors, Your Honor. I understand that under Haram, there's the exception to Miranda for a brief roadside detention, that an officer doesn't have to read your Miranda the second he walks up to your car because you have a taillight out. And I'm not saying that they should have to. But there's a point where walking up to somebody because there's a car parked in the street or you have a taillight out, to where the officer is trying, one, you're not free to go, even especially if the officer admits it and states it, but that they are trying to get incriminating evidence out of you, the citizen. Sakala said he didn't want to talk to him, he didn't want to answer questions. They kept coming after him with the questions. And then they forced him, under threat, to comply with field sobriety tests.
He
went so far as to manhandle him, handcuff the man, and then, according to the officer, he voluntarily submitted to a PBT. The record shows that at no point was Sakala voluntarily engaging with these officers. He was not free to leave. I would say that he was seized prior to there being seized and put to the field sobriety test prior to any reasonable basis for that.
Well, did he ask
the officer, Sergeant Davis, when he walked out, was that?
I'm sorry. So didn't the officer have a basis for reasonable suspicion? He observed slurring speech issues with your client, smelled alcohol. He'd gotten the call. He had the facts from the 911 call that there was towing. This car was just left in the intersection. So why does that not satisfy a reasonable suspicion standard? And isn't that all you need at this point to ask him to go through the roadside DWI protocol test?
All the officer knew from the call was that a vehicle, a BMW, had been towed, and he got a description of a gentleman in a red t-shirt, which was not the appellant. He got on the scene with two individuals, appellant and the other gentleman in the red t-shirt, were having harsh words with the neighbor. The officer walked up on that basis and took control of the scene pursuant to his testimony. Once you're seized and you're not free to go, an aggressive interrogation began immediately here. If the appellant had tried to walk away, he would have been, 609-437, fleeing on foot, or other than in a motor vehicle, which I think the district court didn't take into account. He was never free to go. As soon as the officer or the sergeant walked up and talked to him, he wasn't free to leave. The interrogation began. And
what about the cases cited by the district court in its order that established that when an officer merely approaches someone to ask them questions, such contact does not, as a matter of law, constitute a seizure?
Well, I'm forgiving, but I'm trying to,
So in this case, how was the individual seized when the officer just went up and asked him a few questions? I mean, are you suggesting that the officer can never, anytime an officer asks someone a question, they're seized?
No, I understand that side of it. But again, there's a spectrum from an officer just talking to me if I'm parked in my car and me being taken in handcuffed into an interrogation room where Miranda and protections offered by that case clearly should.
So at what point, in your view, did it become a seizure in this case?
Well, the officer began aggressively interrogating both of these gentlemen.
And what specific questioning, in your view, constituted aggressive interrogation?
Well, he immediately began asking who was driving the vehicle. He's asking incriminating questions as to who left the vehicle.
Aren't you conflating the two issues? I mean, Miranda applies and is required when you have in custody interrogation. You seem to be suggesting that the interrogation itself creates the custody. And I'm not sure if the case law that you've cited supports that proposition. Is that your position? And if so, what case are you relying on?
Well, I'm relying on the Ferry case, Your Honor, where it's an on the street officer walks up to an individual and starts questioning him. My point, what we have and what happened here is that an officer can walk up to an individual. I'm not saying that should be illegal or banned. But the government wants to be able to walk up and detain you and then ask you incriminating questions.
Right, but going back to Judge Cochran's question. When she asked you at what point was your client seized for the purpose and taken into custody for the purpose of implicating Miranda, you said when the officer started interrogating.
Correct.
And so I guess I want to understand your answer to the point. You seem to be suggesting that interrogation, aggressive or otherwise, is sufficient to constitute custody. And I think it's clear, maybe we can determine when the interrogation began. My question is, when did the custody begin? And what were the circumstances that you that support that proposition?
I understand your question. When the officer, well, first, obviously, when it's physical force, which happens here, but earlier in this one, when the officer said, either you do X, Y, and Z, or I'm going to arrest you, the threat of arrest, I think, is when that clearly comes into power, Your Honor.
So you're saying the threat of custody constitutes custody? Well, but we've got case law that says that even when an individual is placed in handcuffs, the individual may not be in custody, formal custody, for the purposes of Miranda. So if actually placing an individual in handcuffs is not custody for Miranda, explain how threatening handcuffs would constitute custody.
Well, I see your point, but the officer's conduct in this case was aggressive. There was no way that the appellant was ever going to have a chance to walk away from this encounter. And I don't believe the officer had reasonable suspicion to use that level of intimidation or force or under his authority. He essentially seized her appellant. And when the appellant said, I don't want to talk to you, I want to go, they grabbed him. The second officer was called. They grabbed the appellant. They manhandled him in handcuffs, and they made him, they compelled him, give incriminating statements against himself and to provide a PBT. The PBT can be refused, as can field sobriety tests, unless, of course, two officers are twisting your arms and handcuffing you. That's the egregious behavior here, why this case was fought. I think the officers were heavy-handed, and I understand the state wants to be able to walk up to anybody, and if they smell alcohol, to compel them to do field sobriety tests. You should not be able to compel somebody when they have a right to refuse. You should not be able to use physical force and the threat of arrest to compel them to incriminate themselves. That, I guess, is my point, Your Honor.
So is it your position that it's just the roadside PBT test that should have been suppressed? And I'll just leave it at that.
The field sobriety test as well, Your Honor. Sakala was not free to go. The officer made him continue to talk, made him do compel him to do the field sobriety test. He said, if you don't do that, then the PBT, then the arrest. That, I believe, was an abuse of his authority to do that. Sakala has a legal right to refuse the field sobriety test. An officer shouldn't be able to threaten you with arrest and to compel you to do something that you have a legal right to refuse. And then, when he gains evidence from that threat, use that evidence to arrest you, which I think is what happens here.
And any other cases besides Farah that you are relying on for that proposition?
I think there's one other. I can't remember off the top of my head, but I apologize for that. But I would refer to my brief for the rest, and I would yield the rest of my time here.
Well, there's no need to yield your time. You'll have an additional 5 minutes and no more, whether you yield or not. So let's change the facts a little bit. Let's say the officer approaches a regular traffic stop, and the officer detects alcohol and potential insobriety by the driver. And the officer says, I'd like you to step out of the car, or I'm ordering you to step out of the car to perform field sobriety tests. And the individual says, I don't want to do that. And the officer says, well, if you don't perform field sobriety tests, I'm going to have to base my decision as to whether you're intoxicated on what I've seen so far, and I smell alcohol, I'm going to arrest you if you don't perform field sobriety tests. The field sobriety tests are your way to show that I'm wrong about my assumptions and your intoxication. Under your analysis, that individual performing field sobriety tests should have the results of those tests suppressed. Is there case law to support that? I mean, it seems to be the regular course, what officers do on the street. You can come out and take, I'm ordering you to get out of the car and take and perform field sobriety tests. I need to conduct my investigation before I let you go. And you're not free to go because you're being detained. So I'm trying to get a sense of where the constitutional moment comes in and what the officer is supposed to do in that circumstance upon refusal.
In your situation, Your Honor, if the driver says, I'm not going to get out of the car, I'm not going to perform field sobriety tests, the officer should, at that point, either he has enough to make the arrest and make the arrest, or he should let the gentleman go,
Is there case law to support that as the only options for the officer?
I've been arguing it for years, and I can't find a good case on it.
In other words, you've tried it and failed a few times.
I charged the windmill, sir. But it seems unconstitutional, from my understanding, to hold me and compel me to point, to follow your finger, to blow in a PBT, to do what I would call stupid human tricks, as David Letterman would have said it. Those are not supposed to be compelled. Yet officers every day compel people to do them. There is a big difference between asking me or anyone to get out of their vehicle and do some tests. And I've seen numerous videos where the officers, as professional, as polite as they can be, and the individuals do get out voluntarily, and they do exactly what the officer was. And most times they end up giving the officer a basis for the arrest.
So what's the alternative? So I'm trying to get a sense of your alternative. So officer pulls up, stops a car, or encounters someone, as in this situation, and let's say a traffic stop, because the same rule of constitutional law would apply either way. Officer detects the odor of alcohol, believes the person might be intoxicated, but hasn't confirmed that suspicion, and asks the individual to step out of the car. Your view is that, let's say it's on the highway, your view is that the officer's only options upon refusal would be to let the person leave or to have already established probable cause to make the arrest. Those are the only two options that the Constitution authorizes the officer to engage in. Do I understand your argument correctly?
If I could fine-tune it a bit, Your Honor.
Sure.
When the officer orders you out of the vehicle, and orders you to stand with your feet together and lift a leg, and orders you to, which happens quite often in the videos I watch in
right.
practice, there's the officer is acting under color of authority. He's compelling you under order to provide evidence against yourself. I don't believe that is constitutional, or should it be.
Under what provision of the Constitution would the officer be prohibited from that? Which constitutional? You have a right not to testify, perhaps, but do you have a right not to perform field sobriety tests to determine your safety to drive? Is there a constitutional provision as to conduct? Is there a case that supports that?
Not that I'm aware of, but it's my understanding that FSDs are voluntary, or they're supposed to be voluntary under state law. Yet time and again, I see officers ordering people, and in a very gruff fashion, if they don't move quick enough sometimes. Again, a lot of professional, polite officers, but there are occasions when it is not polite, and it is an order from a man with a badge and a gun to stand up and do actions that they will use against you as evidence in court, often on film.
Thank you.
That makes my time now.
Well, it does, but you will have the additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Chuck Rordans, Assistant Attorney General in the Office of Minnesota Attorney General Keith Ellison. And I am appearing on behalf of the Commissioner of Public Safety. Your Honor, is based on the district court record, the evidence in the case, and the transcript, this court must affirm the district court's order. The appellant has raised the issue of whether there was a seizure and custodial interrogation, and when the officers, Officer Castriva and Sergeant Davis, approached the appellant in the middle of the street in Brainerd, merely to ask some questions. The officers had a 911 T-shirt who had exited that vehicle, and the car was just sitting there. This report was contemporaneous with the actual events. Officer Tostriva and Sergeant Davis responded within 5 to 7 minutes. And when they got to the location, they confirmed that there was a BMW in the street, and they saw two individuals just a little ways down the block. A man in a red T-shirt and a person standing and a gentleman standing next to him. Now, the officers walked up to that person, to those people, Sergeant Davis did at first. And as you said, Judge Ross, is it a seizure simply to walk up to somebody and ask questions? And no, it is not. For purposes of the Fourth Amendment, it is not a seizure to simply walk up to a person or vehicle in a public place. That's state VOSO. And, Your Honor, the officers they've got a BMW in the middle of an intersection. It's an ongoing road hazard. When they're walking up to these two individuals, the man in the red T-shirt, who they know is one of the people involved from the 911 call, and there's not a whole lot of other people standing around. I mean, these are the two gentlemen involved in this situation. These officers have to figure out a number of real-world solutions to this just issue. There's a car in the middle of the intersection. They got to figure out, how did it get there? Who got it there? What do we do about it? Where do we take it? And there's the person in the red T-shirt. So when they...
Counsel, can I interrupt you for one quick question? So appellant's counsel pointed out that Sergeant Davis admitted that at some point while he's chatting with the two, that they were no longer free to leave. So what cause did Sergeant Davis have at that point, and what's the impact of that admission in his testimony?
Yes, Judge Siegel, thank you. The district court pointed out that the time for the appellant to leave was brief. However, he did have an opportunity to leave. However, I would quickly reference the standard of a essentially, Your Honors, the officers knew that this person with the red T-shirt and this other person were involved with the BMW being there. The other person, the appellant, is somebody who they had previous contacts with, and they both testified that this person, when he is sober, is well-spoken and articulate. So when Sergeant Davis goes up and he sees these two gentlemen there, and he knows they're responsible for the vehicle being in the BMW, BMW being in the intersection, he almost immediately notices that the appellant in this case is swaying, losing his balance, and slurring his speech, and not making a whole lot of sense. However, he almost voluntarily offers that he was driving the Ford Explorer referenced in the 911 call and towing the BMW when the tow strap broke. And then he also looks back to his driveway where the Ford Explorer is. So at that point, Your Honors, Sergeant Davis has reasonable suspicion that the appellant was the person driving the Ford Explorer, and also that the appellant is under the influence of alcohol because he's having trouble standing, frankly. Nonetheless, yes, Your Honor.
I may have engaged in an involuntary movement.
Well, let me since you've paused, let me merge in here.
Yes, sir.
So, let's change the facts a little bit. Somehow we've just lost focus. I'm not sure, but we see you, but you're in a cloud.
Sorry,
no, it's not your fault. The camera somehow just went blurry, but we see you, and we can hear you. So let's proceed. So let's assume that, well, in this case, Sergeant Davis's report indicated that he told your client that he would request a breath sample for a preliminary breath test and field sobriety tests, and would place him under arrest if he refused. Would you agree that the law, or maybe you just ask the question directly, does an officer's authority under the Constitution justify an arrest for refusal to submit to a preliminary breath test or field sobriety tests?
It does, Your Honor. Thank you, Judge Ross. It does. However, the officer has to have probable cause to make that arrest, and so
Just so I'm clear, the state is not saying that it is the refusal to perform field sobriety tests or preliminary breath tests that would warrant an arrest. It is the officer's independent probable cause to believe the person's under the influence of alcohol.
Yes, Your Honor.
So what do you do in that circumstance where the officer, let's assume that your client, just for the sake of our argument here, was not apparently intoxicated but had apparently been drinking, and the officer asked for the performance of field sobriety tests and there's a refusal. Do you agree with Mr. Kinley, then, that the only officer's only option is to let the individual go?
Yes, Your Honor. That's a qualified yes, Your Honor. Sergeant Davis testified at the hearing that if he walked up and started asking these two gentlemen questions, and he found that the appellant was intoxicated, but that he hadn't drove, and that there was no reasonable suspicion or probable cause to believe that he had been the one driving the Ford Explorer, then Sergeant Davis testified that, this is just a drunk guy on the street.
Well, my question is different. I'm focused on the driver. Let's assume that the officer has reasonable suspicion to believe that the individual he's encountering was driving and was intoxicated while driving, but refuses to perform field sobriety tests. Only with reasonable suspicion, though, and not probable cause yet, having not observed the PBT results or the field sobriety test results. What are the officer's options at that point upon refusal to perform either the PBT or the field sobriety test?
Your Honor, it's our contention that if the reasonable suspicion rises to the level of probable cause,
well, then it's no longer just reasonable suspicion. You're changing the facts. This is like a law school exam where if this were the question, here's how I'd answer it. You have to answer the question. What is the question presented is reasonable suspicion. What do you do if all you have is reasonable suspicion and you need the PBT or the field sobriety test to get to probable cause or something more than you've already observed?
It's really a question of degree.
But you're saying in this case that's not our. You're saying in this case those aren't our circumstances because of the apparent extent of the defendant's intoxication.
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct. However, if the appellant had refused to do field sobriety tests and had refused to take a PBT test, then Sergeant Davis would have had to rely on his 13 years of experience with the Brainerd Police Department, his 15 years of experience as a paramedic. He would have to rely on whether the indicia of intoxication of the appellant was to a degree that he had probable cause to be able to arrest the appellant. He can't arrest the appellant based on reasonable suspicion.
Would a defendant's refusal to participate in field sobriety tests bear on the officer's consideration of guilt for the purposes of probable cause determinations?
I think so. Yes, Your Honor. He is innocent until proven guilty, of course, Your Honor. But consciousness of guilt, refusal to participate in the field sobriety tests would be, I believe, a factor going into whether Sergeant Davis developed probable cause.
Do you agree with Mr. Kinley that a defendant's right not to give incriminating, a defendant's right not to participate in field sobriety tests has the same constitutional protection as a defendant's right not to give incriminating statements?
Your Honor, it's not protected by the Constitution. However, I have to admit, I just know kind of the real world application here from what the officers, from what these cases have meant to me or have instructed me. But if petitioners can refuse to take a field sobriety test, it's not protected by the Constitution, but they do not, they cannot be compelled, or at least officers in their real world application of their duties, they cannot compel people to take field sobriety tests.
But I gather you're saying that because there's no constitutional protection, the officer still could use that refusal as some factor to determine reasonable suspicion or probable cause, where you could not, when it comes to refusal to give answers.
Yes, Your Honor.
Can I take you back to the beginning of the encounter between the beginning of the officer's questioning of appellant? Appellant's counsel argues that if the appellant had not responded to the questions and had left, that would constitute fleeing a police officer in violation of state law. Can you respond to that argument? In other words, he's arguing that appellant wasn't free to leave because if he did so, he'd be violating state law.
Thank you, Judge Cochran. Your Honor, there's no evidence in the record to support that contention. That is speculation. Sergeant Davis, Officer Kostruba, never testified that if when they walked up to start asking questions, if the appellant had turned around and walked away, they never testified that they would arrest him or detain him at that point. He voluntarily answered the officer's questions. I would reference you to page 15 of the transcript briefly, Your Honor.
Well, hypothetically, if someone did not answer an officer's questions and just walked away, would that constitute fleeing a police officer?
In
violation of state law?
No, it wouldn't. If there's no reasonable suspicion to temporarily detain them, and if there's no probable cause to arrest them, they're free to go. They're free to walk away.
What about after being detained? If a detention had occurred, and then there's a walking away or a running away, would that justify a fleeing charge and conviction?
Yes, sir.
So
that is our contention.
Well, wasn't
yes,
the and what happened in this case? Was there a detention? We asked you, Mr. Kinley, this. We'll ask you. When did the detention begin? He makes an argument for when the seizure began. What's the state's position as to the moment when a detention began in this case?
Thank you, Your Honor. I think that really gets right to the question, Judge Ross. And the detention did not begin until the field sobriety tests occurred, because Sergeant Davis is questioning the appellant. If the appellant answers in such a way prior to the field sobriety tests that Sergeant Davis did not believe that he was either driving or that he was under the influence to constitute DWI, he would have let him go.
I thought you said reasonable suspicion developed before the field sobriety test.
Reasonable suspicion, yes, Your Honor, and
so,
requiring a temporary detention. However, if he had answered questions such that that Sergeant Davis was fine with him walking away, that would have been the time to do it.
I guess I'm still a little foggy then. So you're saying that you're doing fine. Are you saying the detention didn't occur even though the officer developed reasonable suspicion before the field sobriety testing?
No, Your Honor. The detention, actually, Your Honor, the detention did not occur until the field sobriety testing because the officer at that point is just asking questions. He's just assessing the facts. And really, now if the petitioner had tried to walk away at that point, then I think Sergeant Davis may have stopped him and possibly arrested him or physically detained him. However, we just don't even get to those facts, Your Honor, because the appellant was voluntarily answering the questions.
Well, you've exceeded your time because we've allowed you, but if there's more questions, I want to make sure that they're asked. And I'm not yet quite clear on when the state's position, where it is the detention began, but I think we'll have to ferret that out from the record. We've given you plenty of balls to swing at.
I apologize for not being able to.
No, don't apologize. No need. We appreciate your argument. Counsel for appellant.
Thank you, Your Honors, if there are two officers in uniform and armed standing next to me, and they testify that I am not free to leave, that's when I am detained. I don't know what other definition other than that common sense one. The officer testified in the transcript, page 8, lines 10 through 20, that he immediately took control of the situation, and I asked, were those individuals free to leave? No. And then you engage him in interrogation? Yes.
But that wasn't immediately. It was sometime after he'd asked some questions of, it was not immediately.
I would argue it was immediately according to the officer's own testimony. Your Honor's asked for cases. I did pull those quickly. State v. Stats, 658 Northwest 2nd and 207, and that talks about factors that combine to create a custodial interrogation. Also, there's Rossi, R-O-S-S-E, it's 478 Northwest 2nd, and it's at 485. And then the Scruggs case, S-C-R-U-G-G-S, 822 Northwest 2nd, 637. Now, counsel agreed that the citizen should be allowed to leave if there's no probable cause to arrest. I commend him for that. The interrogation here, this is a distinction I think is important. The officer wasn't just smelling like a, when you grab somebody on the side of the road, you know they're in the vehicle, you know they're driving. So you're just looking for the smell of alcohol and then develop the bill problem cause. Here, in the interrogation, after the seizure of the appellant, they were also seeking, and according to the officer's own testimony, did get an admission to driving, which without that, there'd be no basis for this arrest at all. The officers also, and I would ask you to please look at the citations.
Well, there's enough for an investigation, though, wouldn't you agree? You've got a report of a stranded vehicle or an abandoned vehicle. You have two individuals, one of whom is the driver, and you have the immediate, according, I think, to the testimony, if I'm not correct me if I'm wrong about it, but an immediate or near immediate impression by the officers that your client was impaired. So at that point, doesn't the officer have reasonable suspicion to inquire, number one, to detain, and number two, to inquire further in investigating the potential drunk driving offense as to whether your client was driving the car?
Even if I grant that, they should not be allowed to aggressively and with threats threats and then actual force twist the answers out of the appellant or anyone. The officers testified that no part of this interrogation or the field sobriety test were voluntary. They were very clear about that in their testimony. They did, however, Sergeant Davis did say that the PBT was voluntary. This is after two officers had wrestled cuffs onto him, and then formally arrested him. And then, of course, he voluntarily gave the PBT, which I would contend is the least.
Well, would you agree with this? If the officer perceived that your client, before the field sobriety test and the PBT, that your client appeared to be intoxicated, and that your client was the driver, that the officer at that point has reasonable suspicion or probable cause to arrest your client.
I don't believe he did in this instance, Your Honor. I think the officer compelled an admission under what I argue, and I believe under all these factors, what became a custodial interrogation. Again, it's the whole purpose of Miranda is so you can't be placed into a coercive environment and have the police pull information out of incriminating evidence or incriminating statements, and then have that to be used against you. And I believe that looks like it's going to shut me off here on this.
No, I don't know. Finish your thought, then I have a question. Okay, so.
I don't think so.
I think you should. I don't think you automatically are going to get bumped off. I hope that's not the case.
Is it your...
It was good to argue in front of you.
Hold on 1 second. I think Judge Siegel has a question for you.
So is it your position that the Miranda obligation was triggered with the threat to arrest before he said he would undertake the PBT test?
I do believe that. If I take my gun out and I set it on the table and I tell you that if you don't tell me that you blew up the bank or whatever allegation I'm looking for evidence on, I never point the gun at you. That's still intimidation. I believe the threat of arrest combined with the physical force used here and the fact that Sergeant Davis said at no point I immediately took control of this, and at no point were they free to leave.
But you the language that you quote in your brief from Sergeant Davis's report and testimony is this: Sergeant David also told Sakala that if you refuse to perform field sobriety testing, that Sergeant Davis would then request him to provide a breath sample for a preliminary breath test. And if Sakala also refused that test, Sergeant Davis would be placing him under arrest. Now you can construe that in one of two ways. One, you're going to be placed under arrest because there's probable cause already. And you can dispel that probable cause after you perform these tests. But if you don't perform the tests, there's enough to arrest you. You're suggesting that what the way this is construed must be that he was told or believed, if you don't perform these tests, because your refusal to perform these tests, we're going to arrest you, as if you're being arrested for refusal as opposed to probable cause for drunk driving. But wouldn't you agree that the testimony that you've identified is at least allows for the interpretation as I've originally suggested?
It can allow for it, but I don't believe that was the intent, and I'm fairly confident from speaking with Mr. Scala that's not the way it was perceived. Either you will do field sobriety tests, or I'm going to compel you to do a preliminary breath test, and if you refuse that, I'm going to arrest you. So,
well,
and again, the officer's testimony shows this, not only part of this is voluntary.
Well, thank you for your argument. We let you both go over a bit. It's a very interesting case. We appreciate your briefing, and we appreciate your oral argument today. Very helpful to us. We will take the matter under advisement and issue our opinion within the statutory period. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
We have one more case for our oral argument calendar, which will be live. We will take a moment to recess so that our interactive television equipment can be removed, and we can commence with our final oral argument. We'll take a brief recess.